Case number 19-2249, USA versus Reynard Crowe. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Mulcahy, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Kevin Mulcahy, and I represent the United States in this case. I would like to request 3 minutes for rebuttal time, please.
You may, and you may proceed.
Thank you. On December 21st of 2018, Congress passed the First Step Act. And through that act, it changed the sentencing scheme for defendants who received multiple Section 924C convictions within the same indictment. Congress applied this new sentencing structure to those defendants who committed their crimes prior to the passage of the act, only if a sentence for that offense had not been imposed on such a date of the enactment. In other words, Congress drew a line. On that same date, December 21st, 2018, Mr. Crowe was already serving a sentence that had been imposed a full 5 years earlier by the district court. In fact, on that date, Mr. Crowe was not only serving that sentence, but he had been sentenced by the district court, and this court had already heard his appeal and affirmed his convictions and his sentence. But in April of 2019, several months after passage of the act, and almost 3 years after Mr. Crowe filed his 2255 motion to vacate his sentence, the district court finally decided that motion and granted it. But it granted it on a very narrow issue. It then chose to hold a plenary sentencing hearing. It applied the First Step Act, those changes to the penalties that we spoke of earlier, and he reduced Mr. Crowe's term of imprisonment by 75%. This was error. There are two reasons that I'd like to highlight that underscore this error. The first is the plain language of the act. And the second is the relevant case law that has been developing all summer. Turning to the plain language of the act, as I indicated at the top, Congress applied the law to pre-act defendants only if a sentence for the offense has not been imposed as of such date of enactment. And as we work backwards through that phrase and start with as of such date of enactment. Again, that date was December 21st, 2018, and Mr. Crowe was serving a sentence that had already been imposed. Congress also used the word imposed. And as this court held in Richardson, a court imposes a sentence when it announces it in open court. This Congress did not use the term for a sentence, it used the term imposed as opposed to a final sentence or the ultimate sentence or any language of finality. And this is important because Congress certainly understood through the First Step Act how to use language of finality. The section we're speaking about today is section 403 of the First Step Act. 403B, the operative language here, talks about pending cases. But in the very previous subsection 403A, the sort of meat of the First Step Act as it relates to 924C, Congress used the language of finality. It said that for repeat section 924C offenders, their first offense, defendant's first offense, must become final before the mandatory 25-year sentence can be applied for the second or any subsequent 924C conviction. So in 403A, Congress used the word final and finality. And in the very next subsection, Congress used the word impose. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I think you may be muted. Forgive me.
You were right. But the statute uses it in different ways, right? It's not parallel, except one uses the word finality, they effectuate different purposes, right?
Yes, Your Honor, I agree that they effectuate different purposes, but part of that is when deciding how or where Congress chose to draw the line, if it meant to include individuals pre-act defendants, it could have used the language of finality in order to include someone like Mr. Crowe, someone who was serving a sentence that had been imposed 5 years beforehand. But because it chose not to, the government's argument is it must have been something other than a final sentence or an ultimate sentence here. by using that language, a sentence imposed, it was pointing to the historical fact that a defendant like Mr. Crow was sentenced. Because while I recognize that the defense probably best argument is this notion of a sentence having been vacated means it is a nullity, it doesn't exist, the actual historical fact in this case is Mr. Crow was sentenced in 2013. And so by using the word imposed, when imposed means a district court pronounces a sentence in open court, Congress chose to include a small subset of pre-act defendants and not a greater amount of defendants as would be required by this sort of more broad reading that's been proposed.
If somebody's sentenced and then the sentence is vacated, and someone asks the question, well, has the sentence been imposed? Do you think the answer is yes, even though there's no operative sentence?
Yes, the answer is a sentence was imposed, but that sentence is no longer valid. It is the difference between the operational fact of a sentence and its effect.
I understand your point, but if you apply it and you give a situation and ask, you know, has a sentence been imposed? I think that people would probably say no. Maybe historically it was, but it's been vacated. So the situation is that no sentence has been imposed.
Probably depends on who you ask.
That's true. That is true.
I tend to agree with most of what Your Honor is saying about what would the response be if the question was a sentence imposed? A sentence was imposed and it will be imposed, another sentence will be imposed again. And so I think the difference here is that a sentence was imposed, and if it's vacated as it was in Mr. Crow's case, it's no longer operative and another sentence will be imposed, but it doesn't change the historical fact that a sentence was imposed. I think another portion of the plain language that supports the government's position here is that Congress chose the phrase a sentence as opposed to the sentence, where a sentence could be one of many, whereas the sentence is the ultimate sentence or the final sentence. And so...
if it's a sentence, does it even have to be the sentence under this statute? If it's that general.
I believe it does, Your Honor, because it says if a sentence for the offense has been imposed. So I think Congress did include that little phrase to hook it to the 924C conviction.
What about the different circuits and the cases that are coming up?
Yes, Your Honor. So the second point that the government believes supports the argument here is the development of case law. There has been, over the summer, there have been numerous circuits have weighed in on cases, but those cases put defendants in generally one of two categories. The first category is just like this court's case in Richardson. These are defendants who were sentenced before the act, but had their case up on appeal after passage of the act. And universally, courts have said that those defendants do not get the benefit of the act. So it was Richardson in the Sixth Circuit, and then the First, Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, Seventh, Ninth, and 11th have all agreed with this. So this is a group of defendants who were sentenced before the act and had their case up on appeal. There is another smaller group of defendants, that is Mr. Hodge from the Third Circuit and Mr. Uriarte from the Seventh Circuit, where defendants were sentenced before the act. Their sentence was then vacated either in part or in full on appeal, and they were awaiting resentencing at the time of the passage of the act. So as the act was passed, these defendants did not know what their ultimate sentence was going to be or their resentence was going to be. There are actually three of those defendants, Mr. Hodge in the Third Circuit, Mr. Uriarte in the Seventh Circuit, and then a man by the name of Michael Henry, who is also out of our district that I argued before a different panel of this court yesterday. And those courts are split. In the Third Circuit case of Hodge, the Third Circuit said the act does not apply to him because he had a sentence imposed previously, even though it was vacated. In the Seventh Circuit, the en banc Seventh Circuit held the opposite, that the defendant awaiting resentencing was the same, should be treated the same as an unsentenced defendant. And Mr. Henry's case is pending before this court. But within these two groups, Mr. Crow doesn't fit neatly in either one. At the time of the passage of the act, his sentence had been imposed. He was not up on appeal. In fact, he was waiting a 2255 decision from the district court. And so because his sentence had been imposed, he was serving it and was not awaiting resentencing. He's very different than this first group, like Richardson. But he also wasn't awaiting a new sentence at the time of the passage of the act, like Mr. Hodge, Mr. Uriarte, and Mr. Henry. So he's in a very unique case, in a very unique situation. So the question is, who is he most like? The government submits he's most like this first group, because at the time of the passage of the act, he was serving a sentence that had been imposed by the district court. He was not a convicted defendant awaiting sentencing. It was only months later that the district court chose to vacate his sentence. But for the reasons that the plain language support the government's reading of this statute, and that Congress chose to draw a line, and where it drew the line excluded Mr. Crow, and that the case law, as it has been developing, puts Mr. Crow more like that first group of defendants as someone who had had a sentence imposed and not yet vacated, this court should reverse the district court's ruling that granted the 2255 and applied the First Step Act to Mr. Crow. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Mulcahy. Ms. Fitzharris?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Colleen Fitzharris on behalf of Reynard Crow. Section 403B of the First Step Act reflects Congress's intent that whenever a court imposes a sentence for any 924C offense after the date of enactment, the ameliorative provisions of the act apply. And this is a straightforward reading of the statute. The first clause of the 403 talks about any 924C offense. That means regardless of when it was committed, whether it was committed in 2013 or in 2017, any offense. In that clause, Congress used the broad word. And then second clause, it used a specific word. Each offense of conviction receives a sentence, not multiple sentences, a sentence. So while an indefinite article can at times imply any, in this case, it's more specific, such as, you know, if I were to say, when I say I saw a great movie last night, I'm not talking about any movie. I'm talking about a specific one. And so to hang so much on this indefinite article, particularly when placed in context, is, as the Seventh Circuit majority said, to pay the word too much extra. The same is true for the word imposed. As Judge White said earlier, Congress is drafting this statute not for the layperson, not for my grandma. It's drafting a statute for judges and courts that are used to background principles about what certain things mean. And an imposed sentence that has been vacated no longer exists. Courts applying the law and people who understand these background principles of sentencing understand that a vacated sentence has no legal effect. It is unusual to tie penalties to the historical date of sentencing. Typically, Section 109 ties the penalties to the date of the offense. But
I still think it's confusing, though. I understand your argument. I think you're making a good argument. But the sentence was in effect as of the appropriate date in the statute, right?
Yes, that is the language. So we
wouldn't say that there wasn't a sentence that was in effect on the date picked by Congress, would we? We would simply say that by virtue of a later decision of, in this case, of the district court, that sentence became a nullity, but it doesn't mean it didn't exist on that date and wasn't effective on that date.
That's correct, but that's ignoring like very significant principles of statutory construction about the background principles about how courts are to, you know, interpret statutes. And so, you know, I think the plain text gets us there. And any sentence in the first clause, I think is a really important distinction. But Congress doesn't legislate in a vacuum. And there are two really important background principles in place, three, I would say. The first is that typically the penalty is tied to the date of the offense. Okay, that's Section 109 of the Savings Clause. But as the Supreme Court explained in Dorsey, Congress can explicitly choose to a different path. And perhaps learning the lessons from the Fair Sentencing Act, Congress did that. So at the point that Congress decided to include Section 403B, it said Section 109 is now out of the picture. That leaves two additional important background principles in place. The first being that courts apply the law in effect at the time an issue comes before them, which in Mr. Crow's case, the law in effect at the time was the law of the First Step Act, where he is not subject to the unduly harsh and ineffective penalties that Congress sought to repeal with the passage of the First Step Act.
I'm sorry, I know you're still answering the question, but why isn't he subject to that? Doesn't the statute tell you who gets the benefit of the new provisions?
That's correct. The people who get the benefit of the new provisions are people who committed any 924C offense before the date of the enactment. And, you know, the second important background legal principle against which Congress legislated was the principle about the effect of a vacature. And it's important that that's a background principle, because in order to depart from this background principle, Congress would need to state expressly that it meant to do so. And it has not done so clearly in this case to say that the Congress did not say that the law doesn't apply to those whose sentences were vacated and who stood before courts on de novo resentencing.
Okay, I want you to help. I want to understand how you deal with the clause after committed before the date of the enactment of this act, if a sentence for the offense has not been imposed as of the date of enactment. How do you walk through that?
Okay, so those are specifically dealing with the same problem that was addressed in Dorsey in a very real sense, right? Because it had people who were on their waiting original sentencing, right? But it also means that anybody who is sentenced after the date of enactment gets the benefit of the law, right? For any time a court imposes a sentence for any 924C offense after that date, the act applies. And that includes people whose sentences were vacated entirely, because the sentence imposed before does not exist as a legal matter. You know, the reason why we talk about unoffensive conviction having a sentence is that it is a very practical matter. The Federal Bureau of Prisons is only looking at one sentence, and from that it calculates good time credits among other things. So once the sentence.
I'm sorry, what? So if that's the case, why doesn't it say if a sentence for the offense has not been why is it tied to the date of the enactment?
Because the date of the enactment, from that day forward, right, when a court is sentencing, and it imposes a sentence for 924C, it imposes the new sentence for anyone who committed an offense even before the act, right? And, you know, it's true, perhaps Congress should have spoken more clearly,
why doesn't it say this shall apply to any sentence imposed after the date of enactment?
Congress didn't have to say that because of the background principles in place about the effect of a vacature. And to depart from that in order to look at the historical sentence, it would be unusual, and they would have to speak clearly. And to the extent, you know, that is that if it's at best ambiguous, and perhaps it is, I'll provide this example. At Judge Coney Barrett's confirmation hearing, she was the dissenter in Uriarte. Senator Chuck Grassley, one of the principal architects of the First Step Act, asked her specifically about this issue and her dissent. He said to her that he is also someone who believes in reading statutes and as they are written. But he said, I disagree with you. And he has said so in the Ninth Circuit in an amicus brief dealing with Section 401, which is identically worded to this, to 403. Both of them were, you know, they're both, so to the extent that it's ambiguous, and I don't think it is, because I think you really do look at the any 924C offense that begins, and you look, and then you turn to background principles. But to the extent that it is ambiguous, the rule of lenity counsels in favor of applying the ameliorative provisions of the First Step Act to Mr. Crow's case. And, you know, and I want to now turn a little bit, because the government has also hinged a whole lot on imposed and the way that the case law has developed on this issue. Hodge involved is all of the cases, the Richardson, Gomez, and Hodge, they involve like a very different set of circumstances than this one, because it particularly in Hodge, it did not involve the vacature of the 924C sentence at all. And in footnote 4 of that opinion, the Third Circuit expressly said that it was not deciding whether the First Step Act's ameliorative provisions would apply if a sentence is vacated. So what we have, we don't actually have a split in the circuits. There's also quite a difference between somebody who is asking to have the ameliorative provisions applied on appeal when the original sentence has not been vacated. It is still considered as a legal matter to be an imposed sentence. Again, turning back to practical cases, very often the Bureau of Prisons is relying on that judgment to calculate sentences. Very often people are in custody, and so that becomes operative. But once that sentence is vacated, nobody knows what the sentence imposed is until there is a resentencing, a de novo resentencing, where everything is wiped clean. And one of the first things that a judge must do is look at the mandatory minima and maxima that apply in the case. Now, in Dorsey, the court talked a lot about the provisions following remand where you apply guidelines in effect at the time of sentencing. But in this case, the guidelines are tied to the statutory minimum. The operative guideline is 2K2.4B. which says the guidelines are the mandatory minimum. And so every time there is a de novo resentencing after a vacated sentence, you begin fresh. A court determines what the mandatory minimum is, determines what the guidelines are, and then weighs the 3553A factors to come up with an appropriate sentence for the person who stands before them on that day. And that is exactly what the district court did in this situation, because it was a de novo resentencing and Mr. Crow's 924C sentences were vacated in their entirety. They were a legal nullity. Sure, they happened as a historical fact, but they had no legal effect. And so no sentence on the day he was sentenced had been imposed at all. So for that reason, the act applies to him. Then there's the issue of, you know, kind of common sense, right? And any time there is a line drawing, you know, we're drawing lines and Congress lowers penalties, we have to deal with potential unfairness. But the government's reading of the statute would require a district court who sentences two people on the same day, let's say Mr. Crow and Mr. Jones, and they both committed two 924C offenses, and they were all part of the same judgment. All right. On that date, under the government's reading, for the exact same conduct, Mr. Jones gets the benefit of the act, but Mr. Crow doesn't. And when Congress Congress's intent was to get rid of this unjust and ineffective sentencing structure, it makes sense that when they drafted that provision, that the purpose of it was to stop the practice altogether of imposing these stacked, harsh sentences.
Well, you could just as easily give an example where you have two people committing the same offense at the same time, and for an unrelated reason, one of them had the sentence vacated and now is being sentenced again, and the other one isn't, and then one is subject to 25 and one isn't?
Yes, but what Congress said is that on the date of enactment, we want these penalties to stop, okay? And it's true, there are going to be unfairnesses, not making the provision retroactive potentially results in some unfairness. But Congress made the conscious choice to say that the changes to 924C are not going to provide a mechanism for people to reopen their sentences like they did with the retroactive provisions of the Fair Sentencing Act, right? Instead, they said, okay, we're not doing that. But from this day forward, if a defendant stands before a court without a sentence imposed, the new provisions apply, regardless of whether they committed the offense before the enactment of the law. For that reason, this court should affirm the district court's conclusion. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you, Ms. Fitzharris. Mr. Mulcahy, did you reserve any rebuttal time?
Yes, Your Honor, I reserved three.
Okay, you may proceed.
Thank you. The issues regarding background principles in statutory construction don't need to come into play when a statute like this one is clearly written. The sort of first principle, and it's not a background principle of statutory construction, is that where the words of the statute are unambiguous, the judicial inquiry is complete. And that's the government's position here. The statute was clearly written, so we never have to reach issues like the rule of lenity or any of these background principles that have been suggested here today. Second, in order for the district court's reading of the statute to be true, it has to add some words, a word or some words to the statute. So it would have to say that pre-act conduct is covered by the act if a final or ultimate sentence for the offense had been imposed. Or they'd have to say if a sentence for the offense had not been imposed and was not later changed or invalidated. There would have to be some sort of additional language added, which is obviously not what Congress did and is not open for the district court to have done when it reached its conclusion in this case. And there was discussion about a new sentencing hearing after the vacation of a sentence would have to begin anew, and there would be a new sentencing hearing, and the defendant would have a right to allocute and all of those things. I completely agree that that would have to happen for a new sentencing hearing. And when the district court in this case ordered a new sentencing hearing, it had to abide, and it did abide by all of those things. But it doesn't change the historical fact that on the date of the passage of the act, Mr. Crow had a sentence imposed by the district court and was serving that sentence. So whether or not that sentence gets vacated and whatever procedural repercussions come from that vacation doesn't change the fact that when Congress drew the line, it drew it here to include only a very small subset of pre-act defendants. And then the last thing I will say is to this last notion of fairness, and I know Your Honor, Judge White touched on there's sort of fairness is in the eye of the beholder. I would note that there wasn't a theoretical example that I will offer the court about like defendants. Instead, I will offer an example from this very case. Mr. Crow had a co-defendant named Mr. Wingate. Mr. Wingate and Mr. Crow went to trial at the same time. Their appeals were roughly handled at the same time. They both filed 2255s. Mr. Wingate is doing 32 years of time related to the same two 924C convictions that Mr. Crow is now doing 10 years for. Unless there are other questions, the government will submit the rest on the briefs.
Okay. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this afternoon. We do appreciate them. The case will be submitted.